Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, a regular feature of the ARS Respiratory channel. The topic of this podcast is sleep apnea, randomized control trial or real life course. My name is Patrick Levy and I will be leading the discussion today. I'm professor of physiology and respiratory physician at Colombes-Alpes University and currently associate editor of the journal Sleep Research and section editor of Sleep and Ventilation for the European Respiratory Journal. Joining me in the discussion are two big experts in the field, Jean-Louis Pépin and Ferran Barbé. Ferran is professor of pharmacology at Lleida University in Spain and is the scientific director of the Biomedical Research Networking Center Consortium for Respiratory Diseases, CBRS. Jean-Louis Pépin is a professor of clinical physiology at Colombes-Alpes University and runs the HP2 Hypoxia and Physiopathology Laboratory, which is one of the world-renowned laboratories dedicated to the study of sleep apnea and chronic intermittent hypoxia. So first of all, could you both summarize the level of evidence that are issued from previous studies? And I would first ask Ferran, what are the data issued from the longitudinal studies that relates sleep and cardiovascular outcomes?
Thanks, Patrick, and a pleasure to share this time with you and with Jean-Louis. The topic is very relevant. We have a little trouble in our clinical practice in order to what we have to do with our patients. Because when we relate OSA and cardiovascular diseases, if we look at the evidence that arises from the longitudinal studies, it suggests clearly that there is a clear association and a dose-response relationship between OSA and the risk to develop cardiovascular disease or cardiovascular complications. There is more or less two kinds of studies, one based on population, another are clinical course. In populations, we have the sleep health study in the US that with many publications that links the apnea hypopnea index with mortality, with cardiovascular mortality, mainly in middle-aged men. We have also data in Australia. If we move to clinical course, probably the more relevant paper, it was published by Marin, the famous paper of Marin in Lancet 2005. It's a cohort of more than 1,000 subjects that attend the sleep unit at Zaragoza in Spain. They follow this population for almost 10 years. And there is patients without OSA, that means snorers, patients with mild OSA, patients with OSA, severe OSA, without CPAP treatment, and patients with severe OSA on CPAP treatment. And there is a clear relationship between the OSA and its severity to mortality and to cardiovascular mortality. And there is a clear effect, a protective effect of CPAP treatment in this population. Also, there's another data from the same group that relates OSA and its severity to the incidence of hypertension. That is published in JAMA, I think that it was in 2012. And, well, all of this data points that OSA is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. But this is the evidence that arises from longitudinal studies.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. And I think one of the questions is whether the level of mortality, for instance, that was found in the Marine study has been found further on in other studies. Jean-Louis, do you think there is any evidence coming from animal studies? For you are leading a lab where this was very much developed. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, so the main criticism that can be addressed to these observational studies, and we will be back to this criticism, is related to some confounders, mainly additional comorbidities that can influence mortality and incident cardiometabolic events. We have in several labs around the world some models allowing to expose mice or rats to a different degree of severity of intermittent hypoxia. And this is mimicking the situation of OSA, with essentially taking into account intermittent hypoxia, but not sleep fragmentation or respiratory effort. However, there are many studies, again, without any confounder, with rats or mice exposed to room air compared to intermittent hypoxia. And there is a clear demonstration that intermittent hypoxia is inducing hypertension. It's absolutely obvious. We have recently published a meta-analysis of all the available rodent studies in the field. And there is a clear dose-response relationship between hypertension and intermittent hypoxia in mice. There is also, and you were a co-author of one of these papers, Patrick, demonstration of early atherosclerosis with remodeling, inflammatory remodeling, and fibrosis of the vascular walls. There is also a demonstration that intermittent hypoxia is acting as a trigger for arrhythmias, in particular atrial fibrillation. So on the one hand, we have some observational studies as described by Ferran, and we have also in very well-controlled studies in rodent models exposed to intermittent hypoxia, a demonstration of some of the underlying mechanism that can explain the link between OSA and cardiovascular disease, mainly hypoxia, sympathetic activity, inflammation, and oxidative stress.
Just a comment on that and a question. You very well, nicely described the model that applies to rodents. Do you believe that the conditions of intermittent hypoxia actually reflect what is seen in real life in patients, or is it a more severe hypoxia?
You are absolutely right. It's typically very severe sleep apnea. And there is still a debate because, as you know, there are some studies that have been conducted with less severe intermittent hypoxia, 10%. And in this situation, some of the studies are demonstrating a preconditioning protective effect. So there is potentially a bidirectional relationship from moderate, and there is also a paper, Ferran, you can comment on that, of Perez-Lavi, showing that in patients with only moderate, mild to moderate, or I say there is a reduction in mortality. And the same thing in rodents. If you apply moderate intermittent hypoxia, you can reduce the size of the infarct, for example. And the current models are mainly reflecting very, very severe sleep apnea.
Yes, a recent publication in the American Journal with mild intermittent hypoxia has a protective effect on blood pressure, for example, that has been published recently, suggesting in the same line that mild OSA could be a protective effect. And there is another variable, Patrick, that I think that is important. That is the time of exposition. Because in general, the animal models, it's a short-term, an acute and severe and aggressive protocols. So in real life, the patients are exposed to intermittent hypoxia, mild or severe, but during a long period of time, that means years. So the protective pathways that can be activated and stimulated by these conditions should counterbalance all the deleterious effects related to OSA. In clinical practice, we see severe patients without symptoms, and some of them without complications. So something is happening that protects these patients from the intermittent hypoxia and from arousal.
Yeah, sure. That's something to take into account. We all know that some patients actually never develop cardiovascular consequences, although they have been exposed for years to arousal, intermittent hypoxia, and so on. Okay, you've been very much involved, both of you, in clinical research in the field, and including some of the major randomized trials. How would you describe the level of evidence currently available?
The conclusion is very easy, and both of us will be able to explain you, Patrick, that the situation is not very, between brackets, happy for the field, because all the main clinical trials had shown a neutral effect when we assessed the intervention with CPAP in order to reduce the incidence of cardiovascular events in OSA patients. We are working in a meta-analysis with individual data from the SAFE study, that is the big one, the major one, with the ISAC patients and with the RICANSA patients. It was funny because if you had three trials with neutral effect, the conclusion is you will get neutral effect, and that it was. So we are, in my opinion, we are at that point now. I don't know what Jean-Louis thinks about.
I think, Ferran, it's important to say for the audience, you are right. Obviously, the three main trials with cardiovascular outcomes and mortality are neutral. But there are also some positive studies, mainly regarding hypertension. And one of the discrepancies we have in the field, you have published a very nice study, for example, in JAMA in resistant hypertension with a significant decrease under CPAP compared to placebo. There are many meta-analyses. Probably the best one, in my opinion, is published in JAMA by David Breton, showing that the majority of the RCTs using blood pressure, including 24-hour blood pressure, and comparing CPAP with placebo or sham CPAP, demonstrated a significant reduction in blood pressure. So can you comment, Ferran? I would be interested to have your opinion. How do you translate a significant reduction in blood pressure, which is expected to reduce the mortality of 10 to 15%, with the neutral effect in the RCTs targeting mortality or incident cardiovascular event? It's a little bit contradictory.
Mm-hmm. But before letting Ferran comment on that, just to mention for the audience that there is a reduction in blood pressure with CPAP that has been demonstrated, but overall this reduction is from 2 to 3 millimeters of mercury in, I would say, the overall OSA population, and it's up to -7, -9 in resistant or refractory hypertension. So this is the magnitude we are discussing, Ferran?
Well, the issue is that, in my opinion, we need bigger numbers and longer follow-up, because it seems reasonable that if you reduce blood pressure, at long term, you will reduce the incidence of cardiovascular events, mainly stroke, for example, or cerebrovascular problems. And this reduction in the incidence of cardiovascular events will be related in a dose-response relationship to the severity of blood pressure. We have no doubt, neither from longitudinal studies and also from randomized controlled trials, that CPAP improved blood pressure. So it should be expected a reduction in concordance with cardiovascular events.
So that is a nice transition to actually go in further detail on the potential bias that may explain these results. There are many, but I just want to list some of these and you comment on that. The patient selection could be one. The duration of treatment, as you mentioned, or the length of follow-up, or the number of events, for instance, the number of death in both groups. What are the most important bias that you identify, Jean-Louis?
I think the selection bias is one of the major issues, because it was not possible to include people with very severe sleepiness for ethical reasons, and it's impossible to let this patient without any treatment for several years. There are some data suggesting that sleepiness is associated with a poor prognosis in terms of incident cardiovascular events. But for me, and Ferran just said that before, the main limitation is the size of the population and the duration of follow-up. We have recently published, and we will be back to this, studies at population level. And in the SAFE study, in Isaac's study in Rixada, the number of events and the number of deaths actually is quite limited. It's around 60 to 80 deaths. This is not enough to have the appropriate power to demonstrate any effect accounting for confounders. So yes, we need big, big population, larger population and long-term follow-up, which is not easy to implement.
And if you look at the three trials, SAVE, RICATSA and ISAAC, it's not the profile of the patients that we see in our consultations, because we have gone to the cardiology department to look for these patients. That is not the patient that comes to you when you are at consultation. Okay, that is a clear difference between the randomized trials and the real life. Because the patient that we included did not reflect the patients that we see.
There is a recent study published in Sleep comparing the routine practice and the inclusion criteria in the three studies. And less than 10% of the patients from clinical practice were in the criteria for the inclusion in the RCT. So obviously, it's not reflecting what is going to occur in a real-life population.
So to be very clear for the audience, to summarize what you both said, in this randomized control trial, patients coming from the cardiology field were very much included, which means that by definition, they were less sleepy, less symptomatic, and maybe less responsive to the disease or less sensitive to the treatment. And this is my next question. Do you believe, and I think so, but you're going to comment on that specific phenotype may be more sensitive to the stimuli that you mentioned, in terms of hypoxia, arousal, respiratory efforts, and hence potentially more responsive to treatment?
I think the level of evidence is not very strong, but potentially sleepy patients are more responsive. But there are two conflicting studies. You remember the introduction by Ferran regarding the sleep and RTNF study. It was a general population cohort. And in this population, sleepy patients are demonstrating a poor prognosis. But in a recent paper in the Blue Journal from the cohort des Pays de la Loire, from the Frédéric Gagnon team, a clinical cohort, not a cohort in general population, sleepiness was not a predictor of mortality. So, you know, it's not totally consistent, but probably patient with hypoxic burden, also as previously discussed by Ferran, with uncontrolled hypertension or stroke population, could be very good targets to be responsive to SIPA.
Also gender, the effect of gender could be different. And age will be a relevant factor that I think that we have taken into account, because some of the epidemiological studies show that in men with middle age, probably OSA has the worst effect. So we could expect that in this population, the treatment should be associated with more relevant improvement.
So we are good candidates for CPAP.
Yes, we need some kilograms added to our bodies. We will be perfect to be randomized.
So interestingly enough, you did not mention the duration of treatment. I mean, we are talking essentially about continuous positive airway pressure. Is there any dose response, meaning that do you need to use CPAP more than 4, 5, 6 hours per day to have a significant effect in terms of cardiovascular outcomes? Ferran?
Well, difficult question if you expect a scientific answer.
I do expect a scientific answer, yes.
Well, we take in the first studies the threshold of 4 hours per night. And it seems that it works in many of the other studies, and other authors have picked the same threshold, 4 hours per night. But it's completely arbitrary and not based in any evidence, and not related to the time of the sleep of the subject, because it's not the same if you sleep 5 hours than if you sleep 8. So we have to work in this area, and maybe to plan, at least to think in the percentage of the night that is treated. If you take an actigraph and you put the patient on CPAP, maybe you can check what percentage of time he really treated or not. And maybe it will be a more accurate indicator of the efficacy of treatment. I don't know, but there is a long way to follow in this field.
Yeah, it's a crucial question again. You know, we have some answer. For example, for sleepiness and residual sleepiness, it's not in the cardiovascular field, but we know that there is a progressive decrease in the prevalence of residual sleepiness when you are increasing the number of CPAP hours. In the cardiovascular field, there are some suggestions from the RCT that when you are looking in a per-protocol analysis, for example, for stroke in the SAFE study, there are some indications that if you are above 4 hours per night, you have potentially a significant reduction in cerebral vascular events. We have some studies ongoing using a specific design. We are trying, and Frédéric Gagnadou is doing that, there are some groups in the US, we are trying to link CPAP telemonitoring to the outcomes, to have a dose-response relationship. And we have a paper, for example, in press, in the Blood Journal, in COPD patients, showing that in clearly adherent patient above 6 hours, there is a reduction in health-related costs. So for sure, there is a dose response, but it's unclear for the moment, as said by Ferran. Is it starting at 3 hours, 4 hours? Do we have an additional effect between 4 to 6 hours? We need more data.
Okay. So as put in the title, we actually want to explain whether there is an alternative to randomized control trial. You actually mentioned the conditions that should be fulfilled to get some positive response or not neutral. But the alternative might be what we call real-life cohorts. Could you, Jean-Louis, describe briefly what is a real-life cohorts and what are the potential advantages that could be fulfilled by this type of cohorts compared to RCTs?
It's more real-life evidence than strictly cohorts. We have data essentially from the claims, from the health insurance data. And now we have this data in different countries in Europe and in the US. And the strength of this, it's unbiased population, including gender differences, age, associated comorbidities, and you can have a very exhaustive databases. And what is interesting, if you look at, for example, the paper published by the group of Ferran in Catalonia, the paper we recently published in Chess with a nationwide exhaustive database in France, these papers are including hundreds of thousands of people with a huge number of events. For example, in our study, more than 5,000 deaths. And in these different studies, there is a very consistent information, very consistent, with approximately a 40% reduction in mortality. What is difficult is to identify what is exactly the population with the higher effect. And we have to continue to work on this data to separate the cluster of good responders. But it's really promising, and it's probably also the way to design new RCTs in the right population.
Yeah. I fully agree that the evidence, or at least the questions that will arise from this real-life database, will point to a different objective. Because in both cohorts, for example, in the French cohort and in the Catalan cohort, it's a clear reduction in mortality associated to CPAP treatment, but not in relation to a reduction in the cardiovascular deaths. It's mainly in reduction of death related to cancer, for example, other reasons like neurodegenerative diseases. So it's surprising. It's unexpected results. Also, there is a clear influence of gender in the effect of the treatment. So I think that we have to work hard in this course to try to put together the different data set that we have in each country and clearly try to understand what is happening. Because CPAP probably is not only a treatment for the obstructive event. Probably it has another effects that goes beyond this pneumatic splint that we learned in the past. You remember?
Oh, I do remember. Okay, so maybe to conclude, if you have to describe or to imagine the future of sleep apnea research, would you say that RCTs are maybe difficult to implement and real life evidence is better? Or would you say that RCTs will be more targeted to the appropriate outcomes with the real life evidence? Jean-Louis?
I think it's complementary. And obviously, as said by Farron, we have many years to work on the real life data we already have, including the dose response question for with CPAP adherence. But for RCTs, I think we should also consider patient-centered outcomes and go back to the opinion of the patient, patient's preference, patient-centered outcomes, and not only cardiovascular disease. And there are also new designs for RCTs, for example, during COVID-19, and Ferran was leading the program in Spain. We are some countries who are using adaptive RCTs. It means that you can change during the RCT the outcomes, the size of the population, you can include associated treatment. And we have not discussed the combination therapy, which is really important in the field of cardiovascular disease. You can imagine with adaptive RCTs, including the physical activity, weight loss with CPAP, some new medication, etc. It's probably the future in RCTs for the field.
Yes, I think that in order to convince the health society and the medical society, we need results that should rise on the RCT. RCTs that have to select a specific population, that have to choose the specific outcome, not composites for the outcomes, for example, and have to choose the specific treatment. As Jean-Louis said, not only based on CPAP, yes or not, another complementary or additional interventions has to be taken into account and to implement in these new RCTs. And in my opinion, that is the way that we should have to run. But we will have the problem of money, because it will be difficult to get the financial support to run these big clinical trials. And that's we from the society, from the ERS, from the ATS, from I think that we have to push in order to get money for these trials. Otherwise, we will always talk and discuss or write another meta-analysis based on the previous meta-analysis, because there is more meta-analysis than original data in this field.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Well, I think that's a nice conclusion. More money for more science. That's very good. I want to thank you very, very much, both. You were excellent, as usual. And I think that was very useful. Thanks for joining us for this ERS podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And also, again, thank Ferran and Jean-Louis for your contribution to the field and insight on the topic. That was very good. You can actually visit the ERS Respiratory channel each month for more podcasts featuring discussion between experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine. So see you soon. Bye-bye.